Looking again this morning at Luke chapter 15, the story of the prodigal son is such a story that you can't just look at it for a sermon and then quickly move on. In fact, we're not even going to read the entire massive parable that Jesus tells. I want to again read just the first portion because the story begins, there's a man who had two sons. We're still on the first son part of the story. We will get to the second son as we move our way through the parable. But this morning, again, back looking at the first son. So follow along as I read verses 11 through 24. And he said, there was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the property that is coming to me. And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all that he had and took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into the fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet and bring the fattened calf and kill it. And let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. You Can't Go Home Again is the title of a famous novel by the early 20th century American novelist Thomas Wolfe. And in his novel, Thomas Wolfe tells the story of George Weber. That's the main character of the novel. George Weber is a fledgling author who hopes to make it big in the literary world. And so he writes a story about his hometown. Libya Hill is in the name in the novel. He writes about his hometown and the people that he knew when he had lived there for so many years. Well, the book is a huge success. But virtually everybody in the hometown is angry because although George Weber changed all the names and the story is fictionalized, people recognize what town he's writing about and recognizes that he's writing about them in a rather negative way. And so in the novel, George Weber receives angry letters bitterly complaining about the shame and disgrace that he's brought upon their small town. We thought we were neighbors. We thought we were friends. He even got a letter threatening to kill him. Well, their anger drives him away. He can't go home again. And George Weber begins a search for his own identity that takes him on a journey to New York, to Paris, to Berlin. The title of the novel, You Can't Go Home Again. Is that so? Or can you? Or can you? Last message, we began looking at this amazing story Jesus tells. A man had two sons. The youngest of the two sons is intent on leaving home for good because he hates life with his family. He hates the community he lives in. He feels trapped. He's suffocated by custom and expectation and conventions. He chafes under being in this little nowheresville. This small farming community, it's narrow, it's bigoted. It's provincial. There's a whole bigger world out there, pretty sure of it. And so he wants to be free. He wants to live life to the fullest. He wants to experience the world at large. And oh, he despised his family and his father in particular. So what to do? He knows what's going to happen. When Dad dies, he says to himself, I'm going to be able to claim my freedom. Because Dad is the most wealthy person in the entire state. I mean, there are few people that have the wealth that he has. And once he dies and the will goes through probate, I'm going to be financially set for life. That was his plan. But Dad didn't die. Oh, he was an older man, to be sure. But sadly, he seemed to be in good health. And who knows? I mean, he could live for years, for all I know. And that thought horrified him. And so, with great arrogance, he came to his father and he says, in essence, understand when he says divide the inheritance, what he's saying to his father is, I wish you were dead. He pretty much says that to him. I wish you were dead. I've been waiting for you to die, but since you're not going to die anytime soon, it's not likely to happen in the next months or years, it looks like. I want my inheritance, and I want all of it now. And rather than the father, in that culture 2,000 years ago, giving to that young man what he deserved, a severe beating like within an inch of his life, for that kind of disrespect, that kind of arrogance, the father says to his son, here it is. The inheritance is yours. And so you notice this young man, it says, not many days later took off. So you think about the inheritance. What was it? It was land. It was cattle. Okay, you can't take that stuff with you when you're going to hit the road. And so he wants to leave quickly, so he doesn't have much time, and so he sells the property for whatever he can get for it. And people know that he's a motivated seller. And so he sells it for what he can get. He sells the cattle for whatever anybody will pay him. He liquidates everything, and he puts the cash in his pocket, and he takes off. And you notice, where does he go? It says he took a journey into a far country, verse 13, into a distant country. Why distant? Because he wants nothing more to do with anybody. He wants nothing more to do with his family, with his home, with his church, with his community. He's gone. And as we saw in the first message on this passage, this father in the text is a picture of God. God is the one being illustrated in this story. And God gives rich gifts. He gives good gifts to all. Theologians call it common grace. Oh, and we're glad for the inheritance. And what are those good gifts? What's the inheritance that God gives to us? Things like sunshine, rain, good harvests. He gives us health, ample income, education, gifts, skills, opportunities. I mean, the list is huge. The inheritance is quite something that God gives to each one of us. And we want the inheritance. Oh, we surely do. But we don't want the Father who gave it to us. We don't want the Father who gave it to us. Last time we left off the story with verse 13. Let's pick it up at verse 13. So he takes his journey not many days later, selling everything, liquidating everything at bargain basement prices. He pockets what he can take. And you notice he squandered his property in reckless living. I like the word in the King James Version I grew up with. Riotous living is the word. What does this word mean? He squandered his property in reckless living. What does the word reckless mean? It's an adjective here. It modifies living. What kind of living? Reckless living. The word is used only three other times in the entire Bible. It's used in noun form. And here are the passages. The first one is in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 18. And do not get drunk with wine, for that is, if it were translated the same as in our text, that is recklessness. It's translated as debauchery. So drunkenness is part of what reckless living is all about. The second passage is in Titus 1:6, where Paul is giving the requirements for an elder. And among them, Paul says, an elder's children are to be believers, Paul says, and not open to the charge of debauchery. Or you could translate it recklessness, if it were translated the same as in our passage. The final one is in 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 3 and 4, and this describes the Gentiles who do not know the Lord, and this is the best definition of reckless in the Scripture. Paul talks about the Gentiles living in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, and lawless idolatry. With respect to this, they are surprised when you do not join them in the same flood of, you could translate it as recklessness, translated as debauchery. So what it says here, this young man squandered his property in reckless living. Ephesians 5, Titus 1, 1 Peter 4, explain what that means in part. In fact, if you look at verse 30, when the youngest son finally comes home, you notice verse 30, the older son fills in all the details. This son of yours has devoured all your money with prostitutes, and okay, 1 Peter 4, that kind of thing. Everybody knew what he'd done with his money. Comes home. And so you realize this young man who runs out of money didn't merely live off his money in a careful way until it was gone. He didn't invest it and then the stock market crashed. You know, it wasn't because of careless investments. No, he used his money to fuel his rebellion. That's what he did. And he squandered everything that the father had given him in a reckless orgy of spending. And it was gone more quickly than he ever imagined it would. Well, notice verse 14. So his money's gone, his inheritance is gone. On top of it, verse 14, a severe famine devastated the land. And in ancient times, there was no safety net. There were no food pantries. There was no social security. There was nothing. So here's this young man. He squandered his entire inheritance. Now there's a famine in the land, and he began to be in need. That's putting it mildly in this text. Sin had deceived him. Sin had destroyed him. His plenty had become poverty. His honor had become degradation. His freedom, that's what he wanted, wasn't it? Now it had all become slavery. So what to do? Well, there aren't too many options in a famine, are there? So you do whatever it takes to survive. And what does this young man do? He turns to begging. And I want you to notice the end of verse 16. It says, no one gave him anything. All right, so obviously he asked, he begged, he sought, tried to get a job. No one would give him anything in that distant country. So what is this young man going to do? He's a filthy, starving beggar. Now, once the son of the king, if you want to put it that way, of a great nobleman. But now he's a filthy, starving beggar. Verse 15, it says, he hired himself out to feed pigs. Hired probably isn't the best word, because if he'd actually gotten an income, he could have bought something to eat. If you have a New American Standard Bible, I like the translation. This young man attached himself to is literally what the text says. If you want to put it this way, he glued himself to. So in other words, he's desperate, he's begging, nobody gives him anything. The pig farmer says, want nothing to do with you. He wouldn't leave, seemingly. This if you read between the lines. He's not leaving, he's not going anywhere. He attached himself to, this pig farmer can't get rid of him. And so he sends him out into the field to take care of pigs. And he has no intention of paying him anything. That's pretty clear, because if he was getting a salary, he'd have something to buy food, something to eat. but he's not getting a salary. And he said, it says in the text, he wished he could chew on the pods that the pigs were eating, but seemingly the owner was watching, so he couldn't even do that. So here he is caring for pigs, nothing to eat, not going to get a salary. This guy's not going to ever pay him a cent. He is in desperate circumstances. And so this young man, as he's starving to death, he suddenly comes to realize that the pigs in the field are leading a vastly superior lifestyle to his. That's when he came to himself. That's when he came to his senses. That's what it says in verse 17, doesn't it? He came to his senses. I will arise. I will go to my father. I will say, Father, I have sinned. And you know what happens in the story. We all know this parable very well. He returns to the father. The father, filled with compassion, runs to welcome him. And as in the other two parables that precede this, because three parables go together, after the lost sheep was found, there was a huge party. After the lost coin was found, huge party. After this son who was dead but is alive, was lost and is found, talk about a party. You notice how it's described. The best robe, ring, sandals, fattened calf, the whole business is there. Because it's good news. The one lost is found. The one dead is now alive. You can't go home again. Or can you? Let me read you something. This is from a book that I read some years ago by Philip Yancey. And the title of his book is, What's So Amazing About Grace? And in one of the chapters, this is the story that he tells. Let me read it for you. A young girl grows up on a cherry orchard just above Traverse City, Michigan. Her parents, a bit old-fashioned, tend to overreact to her nose ring, the music she listens to, and the length of her skirts. They ground her a few times, and she seethes inside. I hate you. She screams at her father when he knocks on the door of her room after an argument. And that night, she acts on a plan she has mentally rehearsed scores of times. She runs away. She has visited Detroit only once before on a bus trip with her church youth group to watch the Tigers play. Because newspaper in Traverse City reports in lurid detail the gangs, drugs, and violence in downtown Detroit, she concludes that's probably the last place her parents will look for her. California, maybe, or Florida, but not Detroit. Her second day there, she meets a man who drives the biggest car she's ever seen. He offers her a ride. Buys her lunch, arranges a place for her to stay. He gives her some pills that make her feel better than she's ever felt before. She was right all along, she decides. Her parents were keeping her from all the fun. The good life continues for a month, 2 months, a year. The man with the big car, she calls him boss, teaches her a few things that men like. Since she's underage, men pay a premium for her. She lives in a penthouse and orders room service whenever she wants. Occasionally, she thinks about the folks back home, but their lives now seem so boring and provincial that she can hardly believe she grew up there. She has a brief scare when she sees her picture printed on the back of a milk carton with the headline, Have You Seen This Child? But by now she has blonde hair, and with all the makeup and body piercing jewelry she wears, nobody would mistake her for a child. Besides, most of her friends are runaways and nobody squeals in Detroit. After a year, the first sallow signs of illness appear. And it amazes her how fast the boss turns mean. "These days we can't mess around," he growls. And before she knows it, she's out on the street without a penny to her name. She still turns a couple of tricks a night, but they don't pay much. And all the money goes to support her habit. When winter blows in, she finds herself sleeping on metal grates outside the big department stores. Sleeping is the wrong word. A teenage girl at night in downtown Detroit can never relax her guard. Dark bands circle her eyes. Her cough worsens. One night as she lies awake listening for footsteps, all of a sudden, everything about her life looks different. She no longer feels like a woman of the world. She feels like a little girl lost in a cold and frightening city. She begins to whimper. Her pockets are empty and she's hungry. She needs a fix. She pulls her legs tight underneath her and shivers under the newspapers she's piled atop her coat. Something jolts a synapse of memory, and a single image fills her mind of May in Traverse City, when a million cherry trees bloom at once, with her golden retriever dashing through the rows and rows of blossomy trees in chase of a tennis ball. "God, why did I leave?" she says to herself, and pain stabs at her heart. "My dog back home eats better than I do now." She's sobbing, and she knows in a flash that more than anything else in the world, she wants to go home. 3 straight phone calls, 3 straight connections with the answering machine. She hangs up without leaving a message the first 2 times, but the 3rd time she says, "Dad, Mom, it's me. I was wondering about maybe coming home. I'm catching a bus up your way, and it'll get there about midnight tomorrow. If you're not there, well, I guess I'll just stay on the bus until it hits Canada." It takes about 7 hours for a bus to make all the stops between Detroit and Traverse City. And during that time, she realizes the flaws in her plan. What if her parents are out of town and miss the message? Shouldn't she have waited another day or so until she could talk to them? Even if they are home, they probably wrote her off as dead long ago. She should have given them some time to overcome the shock. Her thoughts bounce back and forth between those worries and the speech she is preparing for her father. "Dad, I'm sorry. I know I was wrong. It's not your fault. It's all mine. Dad, can you forgive me?" She says the words over and over, her throat tightening even as she rehearses them. She hasn't apologized to anyone in years. The bus has been driving on since Bay City. Tiny snowflakes hit the road and the asphalt steams. She's forgotten how dark it gets at night out here. A deer darts across the road and the bus swerves. Every so often, a billboard, a sign posting the mileage to Traverse City. Oh God. When the bus finally rolls into the station, its air brakes hissing in protest, the driver announces in a crackly voice over the microphone, "15 minutes, folks. That's all we have here." 15 minutes to decide her life. She checks herself in a compact mirror, smooths her hair, and licks the lipstick off her teeth. She looks at the tobacco stains on her fingertips and wonders if her parents will notice if they're there. She walks into the terminal not knowing what to expect. And not one of the 1,000 scenes that have played out in her mind prepare her for what she sees. There in the concrete walls and plastic chairs bus terminal in Traverse City, Michigan, stand a group of 40 brothers and sisters and great aunts and uncles and cousins and a grandmother and great-grandmother to boot. They are all wearing ridiculous-looking party hats and blowing noisemakers. And taped across the entire wall of the terminal is a computer-generated banner that reads, "Welcome home." Out of the crowd of well-wishers breaks her dad. She looks through tears and begins her memorized speech. "Dad, I'm sorry." "I know," he interrupts her. "Hush, child. We've got no time for that. No time for apologies. You'll be late for the party. A banquet's waiting for you at home." That's our text. And that's the grace of God for sinners.